Our main speaker, Don Maxwell from Valley Village, California.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Don. I'm an alcoholic. And happy to stand before you tonight. Well, happy to be able to stand up on a Thursday night. Didn't used to be that way. I don't know about you guys. Welcome to the newcomers. I'm sorry that there weren't any birthdays, but in a way it's good because I'll be able to include all my wives in my story. It's I don't know. I mean, you know, when you think about it, when they were reading chapter 5, it says that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And I didn't quite get that from the get-go. And I thought if I had that right girl and a right job, and if people would just respect me, you know, that things would, I wouldn't have to go out and do the things. And if I would have just read that, I would be happy and lots of ladies. I don't know. I'm from Los Angeles, Valley Village, you know, it's the San Fernando Valley. I don't know if I have the record in here. It's Las Vegas. I don't know if I have the record for the most wives, but I was counting it up on the plane. And in my lifetime, I've had 8 wives. I know. No, only 3 of them were mine. All right, you know. So but I count them. So, you know. So you can see that I am a substance abuser. You know, I I'm an alcoholic. I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at Radford. I met a young man over there who knows Larry, who knows Radford and North Hollywood. And it was a great, great place. And there I was taught what you guys talk about here. I was taught about service and about how I can feel better. It tells me in this book that nothing will so much ensure immunity from the first drink as intensive work with another alcoholic. And so I learned that early on. I have a great sponsor, and he taught me that early on. I got to Alcoholics, and I'm sober since 1981. I now have been sober as long as I drank. And I never thought that would happen. You know, and next year I move ahead, you know, if I keep doing what I was doing. But I started drinking young. I was 17 when I took my first drink, which would make me kind of a lightweight these days. But I remember I got it. My dad wouldn't let me drink. And you know, when he wasn't around, then I was able to do whatever I wanted. And I took that first drink and it went down. And it felt so good. I don't know why I would be explaining this to you guys. It's silly. And for the first time in my life, I stood up and I felt like I was 6'2", and I could take, I'm already 6'4", but it made me feel like I'm 6'2", I can take the world on, and I was to do what I was to do for the next 21 years. I was to say, if one drink makes me feel this good, what do you suppose 2 drinks will do? And 3 and 4. And newcomers, we're glad you're here tonight because you hear the stories. You heard Stephanie early, and she talked about it from a lady's side of the aisle. And, you know, it's really important because the fact of the matter, and it mentions this in this book, how alcohol affects the women harder than the men, and it's been proven about 10 years ago that they came up with it, that women are, you know, I don't know if you have it here. I'm sure you do. North Las Vegas, we have Skid Row, and you just don't see very many women on Skid Row because women can't last. The men just seem to be, you know, they're a little tougher. And here's the other thing. You know, a man gets to be 20 years old and he's drinking. It's, you know, a little bit off. But, you know, as he gets older, you know, it's just how quaint. But a woman that's drinking somehow is treated differently than a man. And I know you women understand that. And so the deal is if you're in here and you're sober and you have these men and women around you who are staying sober, might be a good idea because, you know, what's out there is out there. You know, it's, I don't want to go back out there, you know, and I did some terrible things in my lifetime. You know, you hear people, a lot of times saying, I'm not a bad man getting good. I'm a sick man getting well. I got to be honest with you, I am a bad man getting good. You know, I was, I used to get arrested all the time and the thing with the women and the jobs and the this and I had that alcohol. I had what Bill Wilson calls in this book a peculiar mental twist. And it's about the second step. It's about that insanity. But I like it better if you came up to me and after I finished out and you'd say, Don, I liked it, but you're insane. My feelings would be hurt, all right? You know, but if you said, hey, Don, you've got a peculiar mental twist, I'll say, well, thank you very much, and I'm glad to see you. You know, and that's it, you know? And the thing is, here we are in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you knew people that stood up and the rest of us in here, that there's some good news. And the good news is you don't have to ever, ever, ever take another drink as long as you live if you don't want to. And you know what? There's better news. You don't have to ever, ever, ever take another drink of alcohol, even if you do want to. Because here's what you do. When you want a drink, you call one of us. You know, my chapter 12 men stag on Monday night, most spiritual bunch of men I've ever seen in my life, but let a wet drunk come in there. Oh, what's he doing in here? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's for people that drink too much, you know. But the thing is, you know, that we have a solution. And, you know, there is, and it's available in this town. I know it for a fact. In the state of Nevada, they do sell it. There's a medicine for alcoholism, and it's called alcohol. And it's really, really good, except for the side effects. You know, going to jail and not going to Costa Rica and, you know, all those things. And a few wives and this, that, and everything. And, you know, and I don't know if anyone, I hope everyone's got a job, but if you're ever home watching afternoon television, I know you guys have it up here, and you see this lady and she's all depressed and everything. And then she takes something, whatever it is, and she takes it. And then she's out in the park and she's throwing her frisbee and her dog is there and everyone is happy. And, oh, it's so great. And at the end of it, it says, could cause dizziness, drowsiness, or anal leakage. And that's a little bit like alcoholic, you know, that's what's going to happen with alcohol. I mean, I don't know about you. Look, it's easy for me because I'm from out of town. I'm leaving. I don't mind telling you. It's okay, you know. It doesn't bother me, you know. But it hasn't happened in the longest of times. You know, I used to go to jail, too. You were talking about, I think Stephanie was talking about insanity. And I don't think you'll know what it is up here. You may have heard of it. There's a mental hospital in California called Camarillo. And it's a big state mental hospital. And I've been there twice. So when I came here, step two was no problem for me. And I saw a couple of people laughing. It's okay. But I have something that probably a lot of you don't have. I have a certificate of competency from the state of California. You know, I have two of them. Okay. And signed by Governor Pat Brown, and he's dead, and Camarillo's closed. So, you know, I have these two, and I'm thinking, you know, things are going pretty good for me, but if they get real bad, you know, can you say eBay? You know, and someone would buy that, I'm sure of it, you know. But the thing is, you know, I used to go to jail, and I used to go to, and the strange thing is, I got sober, and from the day I got sober until this day, right now, I haven't spent one night in jail. I haven't spent one night in a mental institution. And it might have a little bit to do with not drinking. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous a long time ago. I got here in 1969, and I'd be an old-timer by now, except for the not drinking part. You know, I liked Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of good-looking ladies and all that stuff. And I got here, I was sent by the court, and I don't know if you guys get that, but you know, and it, well, this one wasn't my fault. It was my girlfriend's fault that I got arrested. I can hear that snickering out there, and I'm going to tell you the story, and you see if you don't side with me instead of her. Okay, it was 1969, and I was keeping my machine gun over at her house, you know, and this was long before automatic weapons were in style. In vogue, I'm a man ahead of my time, and she got mad at me for whatever reason, and she said, leave, and she says, take this with you, and so I took it, and you know, I would have been okay, except for, you know, if I would have just gone out, opened my trunk, put the gun in the trunk, did it, you know, breathe, and try and drive home, you know, but except I didn't have a car. I meant to have a car. You know, in this book it says we all have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we cannot live up to them even if we wanted to. And one of my philosophical convictions was it would be nice to have a car, and I had a few cars. And the fact of the matter is, until I got alcohol, from the time I was 16 until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1981, I had a lot of cars, but they always had a woman's name first, followed by registered owner over here, you know, which means they either gave, starting with my mom, of course, you know, like you do, and then down the line, which means that they either gave me the car or signed for the car, which pretty much the way I drank meant they were giving me the car, and I always meant to pay them, you know. I always used to like to go out to bars to drink. I don't know if there's not a a requisite that you're a bar drinker. A lot of people drink at home. I am a bar drinker. I like to go out there, and I have an ego about the size of Wisconsin, and I used to like to go in there, you know, and have a few drinks before, you know, from a bottle that I'd gotten from Tijuana, you know, the cheap stuff, and then go in there, and because, you know, drinks were 75 cents in those days, and, you know, for a shot, and I'd go in there, and I like to get in front of a smoked mirror, you know, and I looked, you know, I'm young and I look pretty good and, you know, cigarette in one hand and a drink in the other. And every once in a while, I'm looking for ladies, okay, because I love women. And every once in a while, a woman would come across the room and she'd say those words that made me know that one more time I still had it. She'd say something like, "Would you care to buy a lady a drink?" And I, you know. And I knew that one more time my charm has exuded across the room. And if I had any money, I'd buy her one, you know. And sometimes they'd stay and sometimes not. And maybe I was charming, maybe not. And you know, this, every once in a while a woman would take a real shine to me. And she'd say, it's at 10 o'clock, and they'd say, "Well, let's, you know, go over to my house. I have some brandy and a fireplace." And I'd say, "Well, wait a second. We still have 4 hours to drink." And some of them would leave and some of them would stay. And, you know, I'd go on and on. And what would happen to me is... you know, I'd stay around and, you know, I used to, when I got here, I was bragging to my sponsor about what a studly kind of guy I was. And then he sent me to this book and he said, "Yeah, well, you know, we have a room full of studly guys like you and we have a page just for them. It's page 69. I said, "What? You know, how the, and I, sure enough, you know, and you know what? You've read it and sex is on 69. And I don't know this for a fact. I can never prove it. But you know, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Do you think we need to know more about alcoholism? I don't know. But I think they put chapter 3 in there so they could put sex over on page 69. I'm not sure that that happened. It could have happened. But I open that up, and I'm expecting to see how I'm going to get more women in my life. And it says that I cannot be selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate. And I cannot unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness. I don't know about you guys, but that cuts out about 96% of my action right there. You know, but what in the world is going to happen if I tell a woman who I really am, you know? And so, you know, we lie and we do the things, and that's why part of the inventory is the sexual problems that we have, and it asks us to put down the people we'd harmed and what we think we did. And then it says something really interesting. What should we have done instead? And thereby we're building our sound and sane ideal sex life. And so when I got here, remember I said I wasn't too good a guy? I had to become a gentleman. I always wanted to become a gentleman. And I had to look around to you guys, you men who are around here and who behaved like a gentleman. And I had to learn to behave like a gentleman in Alcoholics Anonymous at 41 years of age. And I see the ladies come in. And it just excites me. And I see them come in and they're down and then they get maybe their first job or their first date. And the women loan them a sweater and a pair of shoes and a matching purse and everything and teach them how to do the makeup. And women get sober. They get a higher power of their very own through working the 12 steps. And they insist on being treated like a lady. And that's who I want to hang out with. That's who I always wanted to be. And I never, ever knew how. I never got up and said, "Gee, I think I'll go down to the bar and get arrested today so they can spray me with DDT." You know, I not something that I wanted to do, you know. But I'd go to these bars and I'd think if I found just that right woman, that I'd be fine. And sometimes they would stay till 2 o'clock and the guy'd be throwing, you guys don't know what 2 o'clock is. We close our bars at 2 o'clock. Can you imagine that? What a concept, you know. And so they're throwing you out at 2 and I'd be pounding on the bar saying, "My watch says that it's 3 minutes until 2. I have a constitutional right to drink further into the night." And they'd say, "Don, please, you go home and take her with you, all right?" And so, you know, occasionally they'd stay. And since I remember I told you I get to go back to Los Angeles, and I'm not embarrassed about anything. I'm going to tell you the real truth. And you're going to, and we go out and we'd look, you know, your car or mine. I always said your car because I was never sure if I owned one or where I had parked it. So I always made sure. And sometimes, and this will be hard for you to believe, but when I drank too much, I wasn't that great a lover. I know. It staggers the mind. And it was not a pretty sight. It was like trying to shove a marshmallow into a light socket. You know, not something that you could, not something that you'd be able to. All right, you guys, but it was a big marshmallow. And one time, this happened to me in Burbank. This was going on. I was a little bit too drunk, a little bit too coked up, and it happened. And I'm not the first guy, Macbeth, there are three things that drink provoke: menacer, lechery, nose paint, and urine. It provokes the act, but takes away the performance. And it was happening to men ever since we've had the bubbly, doesn't even have to bubble, just so it's got some alcohol in it. I'm with this girl, and it happened, the thing, and I said to her, gee, this has never happened to me before. And I wish you guys could see it from up here, because all the girls are going, yeah. And all the guys are going, shut up, Maxwell. I said, gee, this has never happened to me before. And you know what she said? She said, yes, it has, Don. You were with my cousin last week. So I drank at her, I'm telling you. And that's what we do. I love women, but I'd rather drink alcohol. I have the allergy of the body, which means that when I take that alcohol in, I'm going to want more. I have the obsession of the mind, because I want to go chase that thing. Because alcohol does something different for me. Normies, if we have any normies in here or Al-Anons in here, when you drink, it'll do something to you. When I drink, and those other people that raise their hand, it does something for us. Let's just stand tall. Let us not be afraid, makes us a man or a woman. And that's good, except, when you go past the deal. And I could never, I always would juggle. I did drugs too, and I'm not going to talk about drugs. In fact, they're different. And if you don't know they're different, there's a new people, I'll tell you there's a difference. We don't do either, but like an alcoholic will go, I don't know which way downtown is, but I'm going to point this way, okay, so play along. You go downtown, and alcoholics steal your money, go downtown, get drunk, come back and say, man, I'm so sorry I stole your dough, and I swear to God, I'll pay you back first of the month when my SSI check comes. I'll pay you back. That's an alcoholic. Drug addict, steal your money, go downtown, get loaded, come back, and you know what? He will help you look for the money. And that's the difference. And it's a small difference, but it doesn't matter, because alcohol is only mentioned in the first half of the first step. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and a power greater than ourselves, is like penicillin. And if I have pneumonia, it's going to kill me, and I have a little infected hangnail, when I take that medicine for the pneumonia in my chest, it's going to take care of that hangnail. So those 12 steps are going to take care of the other things that are bothering us. That's proved by the number of different kind of 12-step programs we have around. It is about getting in touch with a power greater than yourself. I had the pleasure of talking with a new guy, and he says, is there one thing that you could say would be the most important thing? And I said to him, probably try and get in touch with a power greater than yourself, because I can't help him. Probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And he doesn't understand me, or I don't understand how he drinks. And the deal is, and that's what they told it. It's interesting. These guys were great when they wrote this book. And at first they say, we're 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body in the introduction. And after they got us in there in the fifth chapter, they tell us that the main purpose of this book is to get us in touch with a power greater than ourselves that can solve our problem. Lots of us have a power greater than yourself. I was one of those guys. But I didn't have one that could solve my problem. And what is a God that can solve my problem? One with whom I'm working. One with whom I'm getting up in the morning and doing an 11th step. So we have these steps, and I don't need to go through the steps for you yet. That's why we have sponsors. It tells us in here in chapter 2, if you're new, or if you're looking for a new sponsor or something, or you're floundering, when therefore we are approached by someone in whom the problem has been solved, there's nothing left for us to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And I had dinner with some of these guys tonight. I can only speak for the men. Well, there was a great example, Stephanie, our speaker. If your women are like that, you help one another. You help one another. When you're approached by someone in whom the problem has been solved, and if you pick up the tool and hold it funny, they might say that's good, but if you hold it like this, you'll have a lot better luck. And that's what's happened, the guys that have gone before. That's what they did for me, and that's what my job. So finally, I drank for the 24 years, and I went through the wives and the stories, and there's just hundreds of just fascinating stories to me. I don't know about you guys. But, you know, the deal is we get sober, and you were talking about it, you know. What happened? Well, what happened was I saw a television show where one of the characters that I identified with, because he was a studly kind of guy, you know, and the women liked him. And I was younger, so, you know, figure it, look 24 years ago, okay? And he was drinking too much, and his boss said, if you don't get sober, you're out of here. And I had been to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting behind, the machine gun beef. Oh, they did catch me. I went to court, and I had got an attorney that paid for by the woman that had kicked me out from Dickens and Shyster or something. I was convicted of brandishing a firearm in the city limits. All right, and I had to do. I was in jail for 44 days, and I had to go to 6 AA meetings. Pardon me, it's hot in here, you know. And if I'm sweating, and I'm sorry I'm sweating, but if I don't, I will explode up here and take out that whole front row there, you know. And if we think this is hot now, let's just go back to what we were doing before, and we'll know what hot is, you know, sooner or later. So the deal is that I got these six AA meetings, and I went to Radford, and they were nice, you know, a bunch of lames, gray-haired old guys like myself. I did notice there were some nice-looking ladies. That was pretty cool. But, you know, I wasn't ready to quit, and some nights I'd go and drink and some nights not, and I thought, you know, a bunch of lames, and I was so lame that I didn't realize that you could sign your own court card, you know. I mean, you can't do that now if there's anyone that has that, because we have computers that check those. We cross-reference them from California, Arizona, and everything, so make sure you get the right, okay? All right. And so I'm getting my court card signed, and I went off for 11 years. And there I am sitting watching this Hill Street Blues episode, and I start crying. I'm in Beverly Hills in a beautiful home and with a woman that really cares about me, and I'm crying. And she says, what's the matter? I said, it's because this guy, who is a fictional character, is going to get sober, and I'm going to die drunk. So I made a decision right there. I stood at the turning point. I made a decision, and I got the phone, and I called, and they said, yeah, Don, you know, come on down, you know, we're having a stag meeting, you know, you'll be a little bit afraid to meet the guy. Oh, what are you talking about, pal? I'm not afraid of nothing. When you see that door get dark, that means I walk through it, all right? And I was scared to death. And I would have made it down there. I had moral and philosophical convictions galore. I was going to go down there, except I opened the refrigerator to make a sandwich, and there was a Foster's Ale in there, you know. And remember what your mom told me? There were guys in Sydney on the Skid Row there that would kill for that Foster's Ale. So I drank it, and I was out for another, 3 months or something like that. And finally, how I finally got there is we were doing a deal. Excuse me, my voice cracked. I didn't mean for that to happen. Make me look weak, you know. We were doing these things where we would get these gals in. I'd since gotten a job in show business, and that was great. We'd gotten these gals, and we were doing these videotapes with them. Not what you're thinking right now. We were doing scenes to show to casting people, all right? And I swear to God, that's the truth. And we were just ripping these gals. We only did girls, too, by the way. We didn't care about actors. We just wanted the girls so that we could teach them how to be actresses and whatever else they needed to learn about Hollywood and how to get forward in Hollywood. And this one was a bad guy getting, you know, I told you. So the thing is, I'm just hating myself. We're lying to this girl, and we got her for another $500, and she couldn't act, which is not a crime, by the way. We're taking money from this girl, and she's all excited because she's seen us on television and everything, and I just wanted to kill myself. I got a six-pack, and I went home, and I sat down at my desk, and my desk has a big I'm not in that place anymore, a big window, and at night, you know, when it's early in the morning, you can see yourself, and I saw myself. And I just hated myself. I hated myself. I hated myself so bad that I decided that I was going to kill myself. And I thought, well, you know what? Not too many people know I'm here. And I want to at least look good. So I decided to get my officer's Marine uniform out with the medals and my nickel-plated pearl. I was never in the service, all right? Let's be honest. Yeah, that would have been cool, right? Then I was going to overdose. And oops, I had already done that on Wednesday, all right? So I couldn't do that. So I'm looking around the house, and finally I come up with it, my instrument of demise, a 6-inch serrated Ginzu steak knife. Good for a lifetime, guaranteed. And this one was going to make it. And you know what? I had done this suicide thing before. And by the way, don't say, oh, gee, that guy from Los Angeles is talking about it. Don't go home and do this, all right? It'll make me look bad, okay? So, and I've cut my wrist before, and it's stupid because it doesn't kill you, and it just hurts like hell when you put your watch on the next day when you sober up, you know? So don't do that. But I had heard someone say that if you'll just cut your throat, you'll quietly go to meet your maker. And I thought, I like that one, you know. And I'm thinking about it. I'm saying, wait a second. You know, they're going to take me. No one's going to claim the body. I'll just go to the morgue and, you know, they don't do anything. They don't even sew you up. They just sort of baste you, you know. And I didn't want to look bad. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to kill myself. I have a peculiar mental twist, but I'm not stupid, all right. I'll just open the collar and cut real low, you know. Not as low as Lorena Bobbitt cut, but, you know, at least look. But at least, you know, and here's the thought. And you guys can laugh at me, and it's not going to hurt my feelings at all if you laugh at me. I'm thinking at that time where I'm preparing to die that every woman that I ever kissed was thinking about me. And that's how you guys got me. Because 2 days later, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into Radford, and I was already engaged to this lady in Beverly Hills, who, by the way, is a member. I 12-stepped her, and she's now a member in good standing in the Los Angeles Pacific Group, you know, and I feel really, really glad that I was able to make up for some of the stuff that I did for her. I'm engaged, but I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous because I remember those girls were there, and lots of them had jobs, you know what I'm saying? And I'm thinking, well, this would be good. I'm looking to upgrade is what I was doing, you know, and I wasn't exactly a vision for you. And I came in, and I don't know what I heard or whatever, and they just said, keep coming. You know, I remember when we were doing the Lord's Prayer at my very first meeting that I was attending, and they were doing the Lord's Prayer. I knew most of the words, and at the end they went like this, you know, keep coming back. And I was thinking, because I'm a newcomer, I'm thinking that they're talking to me, you know, and I thought it was like the wave, and they would just wave around the room till it got into me. And I thought, well, if they want me back this much, I'll be back tonight. And I started coming, and I met a man by the name of Cliff P., in whom the problem had been solved, and he was just a gruff old ex-boxer who was as sweet as could be. And he got me immediately into this book, and he started getting me to come to meetings. And by this time, I had no car, pretty usual for me, because I already told you how I did things. And he would come all the way from Burbank over to Sherman Oaks, where I live, and he would take me to a meeting. And at first, I thought he might be gay, you know. And I'm sure I was really an attractive-looking thing when I got here. And I was old and run down. So, you know, but that's how the mind works, you know. What happened was he saw a man who was dying from the disease of alcoholism, and he tried to help me. And he got me into this book immediately. And the thing about Cliff that I love, he's still my sponsor, And the thing I love about him is at the end of the meeting, like I'm looking out here, there's some beautiful women in this room. But at the end of the meeting, my sponsor, Cliff, would be in this room, and he'd be going to find one of those new guys that had maybe one tooth. And talking to him about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got that man, and I started trying to behave like him. Started trying to be like Cliff. And I'd be there, and every once in a while, he'd say, and what do you think, Don? And I'd go, oh, well, I've been sober for 3 months, and I like it. It's pretty nice. And I read a couple of chapters in the big book, you know, and he was so great. And we'd do these 12-step calls and 12-step calls. And he sat me down at 6 months. And, you know, it says in here in chapter 2, almost no one likes the self-searching, leveling of pride, the confession of shortcomings the process requires for its successful consummation. And there was that looking for my shortcomings in the fourth step. And he started me out when I was 6 months sober. And I'm sorry to say, but I'm going to tell the truth up here, I didn't finish it till I was 13 months sober. And he would, and you know what, newcomers, you can't fool the sponsors, because, you know, how's that inventory coming? Oh, it's great, you know. We know better than that, because if someone's doing the inventory, they're calling you up and saying, oh, my gosh, you know what I just found out? You know, I was so mad at her, but it was me. I was, you know, and that's what happens. So we can tell the difference. So stop trying to fool us, all right? Would you do that for me? And the deal is he was so sweet with me. And finally what happened was a fellow by the name of Steve C., came to me. He was 17-year-old tattooed biker from New Jersey. And he came up to me, and I was 13. I was 11 months sober. And he said, would you be my sponsor? And I said, oh, this is good. The cream has finally risen to the top in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll check it out with Cliff. Just bear with me a second. I went over to Cliff, and I said, Steve wants me to sponsor him. And you know what my sponsor said to me? He said, poor Steve. I said, wait, what are you talking about? He said, I go to meetings with you. We go on 12-step calls. I'm there. We do this. We go to coffee, all this. He says, you can tell Steve how not to drink for 11 months, but you can't help him with his 4-step because you haven't done one. The man had me on a technicality there. So, peculiar mental twist, but no dummy. I'm over here writing, oh, I'm resentful with my mother because she did this, and Steve, we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become, I'm afraid of this there. And you know, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Could the future condition, conditional of can. So we're going to have to do some work here. No. Oh, gosh, what I did to that one. Oh, man, I'm going to have to apologize to her, too. Jeez. Oh, all right. And then, we do the 3rd-step prayer. The decision to turn our will and life over the care of God is well understood. And that's just a decision. Then it will have a little permanent effect unless at once followed by a willingness to face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. And I sat him down and I told him, we're going to write about resentments. We're going to write about fears. And we're going to write about sexual problems. And he says, yeah, what about that 5th step? I said, don't worry about the 5th step. We're going to do that sometime after July 7th. All right? So just relax. And I beat him. And that little 17-year-old guy, who's 40 now, 40 years old, I talked to him a few days ago, saved my life. You know, you just don't know how God's going to talk to you. And so what happened is I had this little teeny Don M. life. You know, I'd been busy my whole life reading my resume. And I was the only one reading it. You know what I'm saying? And I got a man in my life, and it got bigger. And I got another man in my life, and it got bigger. And like this, and like this, and like this, and I got really big life. And I got here, and I was a survivor. You know, we're all survivors. Everyone in this room is a survivor. And I started listening to you guys for a few weeks, and I was way up here getting by, you know. And if a survivor walked through that door, I could help him out. And then I did these 12 steps, and I got a God of my very own, and I live way, way up here, child of God, sober man. The only guy that can take me down there is me. And I'm not planning to do it today. But I got to do the stuff. And I'm not perfect. You know, I have flaws like everyone else. You know, we were giggling in the car, Kevin and I, about someone that was stayed at a stop sign for just an inordinate amount of time. And we were saying, we're both better driving when we get an alcoholic in the car with us. And, you know, and that's me too, because I used to just get after them. You know, they'd come in and I'd trace them and I'm driving along and then drive and get up and beside them just so I could get that eye contact. And I go, like that, you know. And the guy looks over and he says, I think the guy in the car next to me has gas over there, you know. And so I never made a point. So chasing people and this and that. Newcomers, is there hope for you? There is indeed hope for you. I am a work in progress, and I have progressed, and I absolutely today positively insist on never chasing another human being on the freeway past my off-ramp, which is Laurel Canyon, you know. So it's sort of like the old days with the sheriff and everything. If you can make it to Mexico, you know, okay. And so, you know, and I want to get better than that. So, you know, I'm a work in progress. So I got this amazing thing, and I found out about my resentments. And then it says in here that the people that harmed us were perhaps spiritually sick and putting out of our minds the wrongs they had done, looked for what I had done wrong. And my sponsor would come up with these huge lists of defects of character. And he says, you know what? If God took these defects of character away from you, would you be mad at her? And I said, well, no, of course not. I'd be a neat guy if that happened. And he said, hello. And then he told me about fears. And he said, you write your fears down, because if you don't write them down, They're just up in your head, running around. You got to get specific with God. And you tell them to another human being. And why is fear a defect of character? Because fear is not trusting God. And in the third step, we said we were going to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. So in a way, it's like lying to God, you know. So we're afraid something's happening. And the big book is real clear on page 69. And newcomers, you can go look at this right away. Three paragraphs, the absolute positive cure for fear, for outgrowing fear. And I'll just give you an example. And here's what it says to do in there. Let's just say take fear of financial insecurity, because I think pretty much we've all experienced that at one time or another. So this is me, fear of financial insecurity. I say, dear God, please remove my fear of financial insecurity and direct your attention to what you would have me be. What would God have me be? Oh, he has me being a man with this much money in my pocket, these many credit cards, this car in California that, by the way, has my name on it, and you know, the ability to make money, this much money coming in, this much money in the bank. And I go, okay. And then it says, step two of the fear process is, do as we think he would have us. Now, what would my God have a man who's afraid of financial insecurity do? He would have me go to work, all right, pay my bills, be responsible, not buy more than I can afford, even though I am an American. And if I am late, at least call the people and say, look, I'm late, but here's when you're going to get your dough. And when I tell them that, try and do it. And at once, we commence to outgrow fear. Two places in this book where it happens right away. The fear process on 68, at once, when you go to God, you commence to outgrow fear. And then in the doctor's opinion, it says that we are restless, irritable, and discontent unless we take that drink that we see others taking with impunity. And at once, we start to feel that ease and comfort. So God, alcohol. God, alcohol. When I got here, you know what the guy said to me, these smart aleck old-timers? They said, Don, you're either going to have to live a spiritual life or die an alcoholic death. And I was a newcomer, and I was thinking over the choices there, and I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here? And you know what I'm talking about. If you understand that, you know what I'm talking about. And so that spiritual thing, it's not so bad. It's kind of cool. And it tells us in that same on 68, it tells us that we don't have to be ashamed of our God. You know, because faith is means strength, and I want strength. I need strength. I'm powerless over alcohol, so I need the manager to tell me. It's like on a baseball team. If you see the base runner out there, and he's a most valuable player, but he needs that manager in there to tell him whether to steal or not. You know, and that's what I need. I need God helping me out. And sometimes I can't talk right to God, so I need to have another man tell me. I don't go up inside this head, up in Donnyville anymore by myself, because there's no adult supervision up there. I need a man to kind of talk this over with and bounce it off of. And I have such a man in my sponsor, and I have several such men and men that I sponsor myself. And it's been a remarkable thing. I remember, and Steve stayed sober, and I got another guy, and I do remember the 13 months that I was talking about was when I finally finished it. And just shortly after that, we got a call for a 12-step call, and Cliff wasn't there. And Cliff was like Cliff was like a god to us. He had 16 years, and that seemed like such a long time. So I called him up and I said, we got a guy. I just talked to him. And he says, well, go out and help him. I said, well, come on down and go with us. He says, I can't, Don. I'm working. Okay. And I said, well, I can't go. I've only got 13 months. He said, Don, did you read Bill's story? I said, yeah. What about it? He said, remember when Abby Thatcher came to Bill Wilson? He had 2 months and it managed to work for them, didn't it? And again, he had me on another technicality. He says, but go ahead and get a couple of people. And get on out and see if you can help this guy. So I looked around, and there was a guy I sponsor who had 3 months, and I got him. He was going to go, and I figured, well, we better have one more guy. And there was a guy, English Bill, 11 days he had. Come on with us. We're going to go help this guy. So we got in the car. Well, you know, us, God, and the big book, and we're going. I'm feeling terrific because I'm the head drunk, you know, because I have, you know, these guys. Yeah, I'll show them how 12-step means done. And we got over there, and I knocked on the door. And the guy came to the door in an undershirt, and he said, yeah, what do you want? I said, oh, wait, I'm done. I just talked to you. Oh, yeah, yeah, well, come on in. So we went in. I've lived in some funky places in my life. This place was like from that wall over to here, a bachelor apartment, okay? And he was going to remain a bachelor in that apartment. And it had a little bathroom in there, and it had a cat box that the cat had long since beaten, and top ramen in the kitchen unit with the accordion doors, and no furniture. Well, yeah, he did have the obligatory cinder block bookshelf, you know, with a copy of The Prophet on there, you know, to attract chicks, and he had this mattress over there with nothing, so we didn't know, so we're hunching down on the floor, and I'm saying, "Yes, God has struck me sober, and it's wonderful," and he's going, "Oh." So I'm thinking, well, maybe he's not my kind of drunk, and I nudge Dave. Dave's got 90 days, and Dave says, "Well, I used to be in the rock and roll business, and I lost my job, and now I'm going to Florida to record a record, and sobriety's really good." And I guess the guy didn't like rock and roll, and so we had only one guy left, English Bill with 11 days. English Bill, you're up, you know. English Bill came over to this guy, looked him right in the face, and he says, "Bruce, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to lose all this." Bruce was struck sober with that. Now, here's the deal. Here's the deal. If your sponsor's told you something different, don't do what your sponsor, because he or she knows what's going on. You know that thing about sit down, shut up, and listen because you're a newcomer, put cotton in your mouth? You know what? God doesn't know anything about time because you and I invented time. We human beings invented time. God just sees. If God has something he wants said and looks down and sees two of his kids talking, he'll just put the words into the mouth of whoever's talking, because he doesn't care if he's got 24 days or 24 years. You know, so I like to listen. I like to hear those newcomers. I like to remember what it's like out there. And so, you know, life went on, and I had, you know, these dreams of things happening. My career started getting better. I started showing up for things. I worked in television and movies, and so I have the rare privilege of being able to actually see myself stoned on the screen, you know. And it's not a pretty sight, you know. And you think you're so cool, and you know you're just about one step behind everyone else, and there it is. And it's really embarrassing when someone you sponsor say, "Don, I saw you on television last night. You know, you were really ripped, weren't you?" Yeah, okay. And so the thing is that I'm probably a little better actor now than I was before. And you know what? I'm older now. I can retire. I have my pensions from SAG and from AFTRA and from Social Security, and I take it easy. I now have a woman in my life that I haven't taken hostage, and she's got 21 years of sobriety, and she insists on being treated like a lady. And I like that. We're very happy, and we just celebrated 10 years in together in June. And for me, I don't know about you, that's an indoor world's record for me. You know, flower to flower to flower, that was my thing. Alcoholics Anonymous makes that possible because we have an AA home. And on Wednesday night, we have a meeting of people in our house. And if she could have some women in and I go upstairs and watch television and they work in the big book, or I can have some men in and she goes upstairs, it's an Alcoholics Anonymous house. And so neither one of us want to drink. I don't want to drink because if I would drink, my sister and Terry would have more time than me, and my ego's too big to let that happen. So that helps me out, you know. And so, you know, the things are better and things have happened for me, and I had all of these dreams. When I was getting sober and before I was getting sober, I used to sit on a bar stool, and, you know, the problem was my wishbone was where my backbone needed to be. And, you know, the thing is that a prayer that is not preceded or followed by action is a wish, and that's all it is. You know, "God, I'd like to win the lottery. Buy a ticket." You see? "Thank you." And, you know, and then we'll see if you win. And, you know, and that's the deal. So I got to do something. And if I want something to happen, I got to make it happen. And I had these dreams when I was newly sober. And I wanted to run a marathon. Not your marathon body here. I'm here to tell you. But I wanted to do it. 26 miles. My sponsor says if you practice, you can do it. I wanted to go to Europe and see some of the art. I love art, and I want to see some of these things that that we see in the books, and I wanted to see them in person. And I wanted to, when I was a kid, you know, I'm in show business, and I wanted to see a Broadway show. And when I was a kid, I used to dance around the house and everything. And I'm straight, okay? But you know, I could kick high when I was younger. And I wanted to see a Broadway show. And I wanted to skydive. And I wanted to get something for my daughter when she graduated. And these were all things, all dreams I had. And I put some footwork together. Not in my first year or my second year or my third year, but later on in my sobriety, it was in my seventh year. I got on a plane with the ticket I paid for, with a credit card that had my name on it. I went to New York. I bought standing room only tickets for Phantom of the Opera, $15 a piece, and you stand at this little place where it's got your number. And I saw Michael Crawford do Phantom of the Opera, my very first Broadway show. The next morning, I got up, I ran, and I completed the New York City Marathon. And a little bragging, if I may, the guy that, thank you very much. You're applauding Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know you know that. The guy that won the race, one of these little spindly guys, you know, from Kenya or something like that, he's sitting back. After 2 hours and 18 minutes, he's got a laurel wreath, and he's drinking Perrier from his hotel room. 2 hours and 18 minutes, I was in Queens. Wait. And here's the deal. Anyone can run for 2 hours and 18 minutes. Anyone. It takes a sober man like myself to run for 5 hours and 15 minutes. And I got to send my daughter I took her to New York, because now I know New York, on my next trip. And I had a frequent flyer miles that I hadn't spent somewhere. And I got to send her to Hawaii with her friends from the graduation. I got to skydive. And one of the men I sponsored was getting married. And instead of not telling me where the wedding was, he asked if I'd be his best man. And I said, I will be your best man. Where's the wedding? He said, it's in Rome. And at 47 years old, I bought, with my own money, my first tuxedo. I got my first passport. I got on a plane with a ticket I paid for with a credit card that had my name on it. And I flew off to Rome to stand up with these kids. And when I was in Rome, I met a Roman. No, I met an Italian, I guess technically. And because I treated her like a lady, she invited me to come back. And I'd never been to Europe before in all those years. And now in the last 24 years, I've been there 11 times. And I know I'm going to go again. It's a neat deal. And I got to skydive in Hawaii. And you guys are saying, well, you know something, Don? It's hot in here. And we're glad you got your fat butt around 26 miles. And we're glad Heather got to see Michael Crawford. And we're glad your parachute opened. But what does this have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous and not drinking? I'm going to tell you, nothing. Well, wait a second. Unless you happen to be a man or woman who had the disease of alcoholism, who wandered through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, found another man or woman in whom the problem had been solved, worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and got in touch with a power greater than yourself of your very own. And then you see, it has everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. And it doesn't matter how much time you have, you can do it today. It's called the 11th step. I'm going to show you how to do it. It's on page 86. You go home tonight, or wherever you are tonight. You thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. You thank God for this wonderful group. You thank God for whatever job you have or don't have. You thank God for the friends that are trying to help you. Lay your head down on your pillow tonight, and you let your dreams begin. Thank you.